Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Today we look at the world of art as it existed 500 years ago when Leonardo da Vinci created The Last Supper, and the 21st century world of contemporary African-American art. Thelma Golden of the Studio Museum in Harlem will join us a little bit later. But first, the world of Leonardo da Vinci. The very mention of the words The Last Supper brings with it the image of the famous painting. The 15-by-29-foot masterpiece is among the most famous paintings in the world. Da Vinci's The Last Supper has been analyzed, mythologized, and even to some degree fictionalized for 500 years. Our first guest has written an entire book about that masterpiece. Ross King's book is Leonardo and the Last Supper, and he joins me in studio. Ross, so nice to see you. Thanks for being
with
us.
Great to be in St. Louis.
You know, as I mentioned in the intro, just saying the words The Last Supper creates this image, and I think we all see that very, very famous painting. That's very powerful stuff, isn't it?
It is. The image of the Last Supper has entered our collective cultural DNA. It's something that all of us know. If we went out into the street with a reproduction of it, I think virtually everyone would be able to say that this is the Last Supper, and it's the Last Supper by Leonardo da Vinci. And so I guess in a way what I wanted to do with the book was to look more closely at it and to look at it, not just see it, or help people look at it, not just see it. Because what I've discovered is in the end, people don't know all of the details of it because there are very interesting things happening in it that not everyone is aware of simply because of the ubiquity of it in our culture and in our imaginations.
Why do you think Da Vinci's painting has endured and others that preceded it and that have come since have kind of fallen by the wayside?
Well, someone gave me a good parallel a month or two ago when I was talking about it with him, and he said, it's like blue suede shoes, that so many people recorded blue suede shoes before Elvis did, but Elvis recorded the blue suede shoes, and it's the one everyone remembers. And in so many ways, that's what Leonardo did with The Last Supper, that he didn't invent the genre. It had been around, it had been painted dozens, scores of times over the previous century and a half. It had been represented in stained glass, in mosaic, in fresco, and altarpiece. But Leonardo really, with everything Leonardo did, he wanted to push it to the next level. He wanted to challenge the way we see things, challenge the way he saw things, and really move the goalposts, so to speak, and change the game with his art. And so that's what he did with his particular painting for an infinite variety of reasons.
In a sense, it's remarkable that it physically endured all this time because it was in some great jeopardy early on.
That's right. And in some ways, that's Leonardo's fault. Because it's not a fresco, and people talk about it, they often say, refer to it as a fresco because it's on a wall, and we just think of paintings on a wall being a fresco. But fresco is a very particular kind of painting. You work with pigments diluted only with water, and you add them to a wet patch of plaster. When it dries, the pigments are locked in. The next day, you move on to the next patch of wet plaster that the plaster puts in the morning. That was not Leonardo's preferred method of working, and in fact, he had no experience in it. So he wanted to paint it very differently, and he wanted to paint using oils. And every single painter's manual of the 15th century told you, never try to add oil paint to a dry wall. It will flake off. But Leonardo had faith in his own capabilities, his own technology, and he experimented looking for the magic recipe, the magic formula that would allow him to do this. And sadly for him, he didn't quite find it. And so within 20 years, the paint began flaking off the wall. And as it deteriorated over the next couple of decades, all sorts of people got involved after Leonardo's death, trying to repaint it, restore it, conserve it, and in fact did much more harm than good. They slathered it with glues, varnishes, solvents, Greek wine, which the Italians thought was not fit to drink, but was a good solvent. And in the end, they caused all of this harm to it. They also repainted it. And as I discuss in the book, very unfortunate things happened, like a door was cut into the wall. I'm sure people who, when you look at the reproduction now, you can see, or if you're in the refectory, you can see that there is this door that amputates the feet of Christ. And sadly, that was cut there in 1652 when the friars wanted their meal to arrive in a more timely fashion from the kitchen.
The most recent restoration, much more recently than the period you're talking about.
That's right. It was done much more responsibly, with much more research. Some of the earlier restorers, for example, when they repainted, they would repaint the foot of one of the apostles. One in the far left, Bartholomew, was repainted as a chair leg. A hand of another apostle, Thomas, was repainted as a loaf of bread, which shows us that they hadn't really done their homework, but also they hadn't. That also speaks to how illegible the painting was in the 17th and 18th century when this was done. But you're right, it was conserved much more recently, beginning in 1977 and then reopening in 1999. And that really saved it for the next generation or two. The restorer, a woman named Bambila, tried to take it back to where, leaving only Leonardo's pigments on the wall. And then she herself added a few neutral passages to make it a bit more legible, but cataloged everything that she did so it can be removed by the next generation of restorers.
But that creates the question, when we look at it today, are we looking at Leonardo da Vinci's work or the 80% of that was done by restoration?
Yes, a good question. And it is critics of the restoration, and there were critics in the 1980s and 1990s when it was being done, claimed that it was now 20% Leonardo. And in fact, it is entirely possible that only 20% of the pigment left on the wall of the refectory is Leonardo's, and then the rest of it are either blank passages or passages added by the restorer. But the what was the other option to let it to lose it altogether, which I think would be a terrible tragedy.
Well, let's go back in time now to the actual painting itself, back to the 15th century. In a thumbnail description, what was Italy of that time like?
It was, in the first instance, Italy as an entity did not exist. Sure. There was a collection of dukedoms, princedoms, some republics like Florence. And the city I'm concerned with, the dukedom I'm concerned with, is Milan, the Duchy of Milan. And that's where Leonardo da Vinci went in 1482 at the age of 30 to seek his fortune with the Duke of Milan, Lodovico Sforza. Italy at this time was very peaceful. Leonardo in part went to Milan in order to design weapons of mass destruction for Lodovico. I'm sure many of your listeners have seen these giant crossbows, cannons, chariots, things like that that Leonardo designed in the 1480s. He was hoping that he would be asked to build these and to save Milan from any invaders. But there were no invaders in the 1480s, and so Leonardo never got tapped on the shoulder by Lodovico and asked to make a giant crossbow or anything like this. But Lodovico was a very duplicitous, cunning, treacherous, unscrupulous character, and ultimately his machinations came back to haunt him. And in 1494, war did break out in Italy. It's the beginning of the Italian Wars. And I'm sure some of your listeners have heard what Harry Lime says in The Third Man about the Italian Renaissance being a period of Italy having the Medici, the Borgia, hundreds of years of slaughter and creating the Renaissance out of that. And the beginning of that really is in 1494, which coincidentally is when Leonardo gets the commission to paint the Last Supper. And so as he begins painting, Italy has been invaded by King Charles VIII of France. Charles has come across the Alps with a huge army, 30,000 men, armed with a fearsome array of weaponry. And so Italy, really from this point on, for the next couple of generations, is convulsed with war and depredation and violence as never before.
And Leonardo himself was at a point in his life where he actually thought he was probably close to the end of his life.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about when he begins the Last Supper. In 1494, he's 42 years old, which me being older than 42, that seems very young to me now. And but 40 was the life expectancy of a man born in 15th century Italy. And so in some ways, Leonardo had lived the full span of years that he might have been expected to live. And in fact, one of his close contemporaries, Domenico Ghirlandaio, the teacher of Michelangelo, died in 1494 when Leonardo began painting The Last Supper. And the interesting thing is that had Leonardo died in 1494, we wouldn't be talking about him this morning because of the fact that he had not, with his paintbrush, created what he called a work of fame. He was very conscious that he had not discharged the debt that his genius owed to history by the time he had reached his 40s. I mean, we tend to think of Leonardo as this all-encompassing genius who could succeed at anything he turned his hand to. And without taking anything away from his brilliance, it is the case that he, by the age of 40, had not created something that posterity would remember, or even that his contemporaries were aware of. And so really The Last Supper becomes that work of art.
I have to take a break, but before I do that, you mentioned Michelangelo. A lot of confusion, I think, today as to what the relationship between these two geniuses was. What was it?
It was not a good relationship. Leonardo was older. He was born in 1452, Michelangelo in 1475. So Leonardo was the older guy, the earlier generation, and he was very suspicious of Michelangelo, or more especially Michelangelo, I think, was suspicious of him. Leonardo seems to have been quite a calm, orderly, gentlemanly person, the perfect courtier in many ways. Michelangelo, though, was a very irascible character, very temperamental, mercurial, and he verbally attacked Leonardo one time in the street in Florence. The story is probably true that Leonardo asked Michelangelo a question about Dante, and Michelangelo replied very rudely and shocked everyone who was standing there. And so it was, art was a competitive sport in the Italian Renaissance, and you were just in the way that people are worried about young Turks today. I suppose the established order worries about the next generation coming up and usurping their position in the hierarchy. Even Leonardo da Vinci had to worry about the young guys like Michelangelo and Raphael coming along after him. And taking over his business.
You are listening to Ross King, who is the author of Leonardo and the Last Supper. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. I'd like to get you into it as well. 382-8255 is the number. If you have questions about this time, this period, and this man, we'd love to hear from you. 382-8255. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, a tweet at STL on air, or you can also reach us through Facebook. Ross King, by the way, will be appearing at the St. Louis County Library headquarters on Lindbergh tonight at 7 o'clock discussing Leonardo and the Last Supper. More information on our website at stlpublicradio.org. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with Ross King, who is the author of Leonardo and the Last Supper. I think the title tells it all. We don't have to explain too much more than
That's
that,
right.
What the subject matter is. Ross, what was his – you alluded to this early on. What was his approach to this this task of this huge, huge painting?
Initially, he resisted it because it was not the commission that he wanted. He wanted to do things for Lodovico Sforza, the Duke of Milan, but he – more specifically, what he wanted to do was to design weapons and become a military architect or civil engineer, or he wanted to become a sculptor and do a giant bronze equestrian monument that was going to be 23 feet high, absolutely unprecedented in scale and ingenuity. But he lost that commission in 1494 when his bronze was confiscated from him by Lodovico, 75 tons of it that he was going to use for this, because of the war effort, because in times of war, and the French king had just invaded Italy, in times of war, you need bronze not to commemorate past military victories with equestrian monuments, but rather to ensure future military victories with cannons. And so it was sent away to the foundries of Ferrara, all of this bronze, and Leonardo was completely disheartened. He'd spent the better part of 10 years designing and thinking about and dreaming about this equestrian monument that was going to make his reputation as the world's greatest artist. And so instead, what he got in 1494 was a commission to paint, to decorate a wall in a small, dark, dingy room where a band of Dominican friars ate their lunch. And he wrote a very intemperate letter to Lodovico Sforza complaining that he had lost the horse and he'd been given another task that he didn't enjoy doing. And in many ways, we can understand his frustration, not only with having lost the bronze horse, but also with having been given a task for which his skills were ill-suited. Because once again, we think of Leonardo as an all-encompassing genius who could do absolutely anything. But the thing he could not do in painting was fresco. And fresco is this very specialized technique where you paint on wet plaster, and he had never trained in it. You went through an apprenticeship, and you had to train under a master for 5, 6, 7 years before you could then go off and do it yourself. Leonardo had no training whatsoever in it because his master, Verrocchio, had never worked in fresco. So poor Leonardo was given a task that was ill-suited to his skills, which as a fresquist, you had to work very quickly. And Leonardo did not like to work quickly. He liked to labor intensively. He liked to think his paintings as well as paint them.
It took about 4 years, didn't it, finally to
That's
complete
right.
it?
That's right.
You know, pop culture, most recently, obviously, but for a couple of centuries, there have been these thoughts that Leonardo had secret messages embedded in the painting. What did you find out about that sort of thing?
I think with our fascination with codes and symbolism is a fairly recent phenomenon. It was symbolism was thought about very differently in the Middle Ages and Renaissance, and I think it's very difficult for us to impose our understanding of ciphers and codes and mysterious symbols onto works from that period, which had their own codes into them, which were very different. The famous one that I get asked all the time, of course, is the about Mary Magdalene. And is Mary Magdalene, is that figure to Christ's right or to the left of Christ as we look at the painting, leaning over to talk to St. Peter or to hear St. Peter's question, is that Mary Magdalene? And has Leonardo omitted one of the apostles and only painted 11 and then put Mary into it? And it's a wonderful story, and it is resonant in so many ways of so many things, but there's absolutely no historical truth to it whatsoever. Back in the heyday of the Da Vinci Code, which was really what kicked this Sure. story off, I used to be asked to come around to groups and give talks on, you know, the real Leonardo da Vinci or the real art of the Da Vinci Code. And I would begin my talk by showing that image of St. John / Mary Magdalene and say, who thinks this is a man, who thinks this is a woman? Every hand would go up when I said, who thinks this is a woman? I would then give a spiel for about 40 minutes on showing androgyny in 15th century Florentine art. I would talk about the relationship between Christ and St. John, the beloved disciple. I would show all of the other Last Suppers in which John is a feminine-looking figure, a very young figure, unlike the elder, more hirsute apostles. And I would give all sorts of art historical and historical justification for why this was St. John. And I would show Leonardo's own fascination with androgyny and his ideal of beauty being halfway between a man and a woman, halfway between an adolescent and an adult. And at the end of it, I would say, how many of you still think it's Mary Magdalene? And every hand would go up. So I'm convinced I'll never change anyone's mind about this if you believe that it is. But all I would say is that when you look at a Leonardo painting or when you look at a work of art from the 15th century, you just because a figure looks effeminate or female doesn't necessarily mean that it's a woman. And there was an entire tradition of portraying John as a female type of figure for all sorts of reasons, which I discuss in chapter 12 of the book.
Well, Dan Brown is very happy with with the effeminate looking one, if you will.
If I could go back in a time capsule, I would take that book with me and go back to about the year 2000 and pip him by a year or two. So it was a very, very clever idea. And it's a novel, and so he can say what he wants in it.
I have some more questions along these lines, but I want to bring in Lawrence, who is calling us from the Baden area. Lawrence, thanks for being with us. Go ahead. You're on the air with Russ King.
Yes. Real quick, what became of that artwork in the Friar's lunchroom?
Oh, right. Well, what became of it is it became the Last Supper.
That was the Last. My goodness.
Yeah.
Anyway, real quick, I'd like to know two things. One, Leonardo, what he had to say and his consciousness of the discovery of the New World, and how good of a Catholic was he?
Right. The first answer to the first question is a very short one. There is absolutely no reference to the New World whatsoever in any of Leonardo's writings, which is mind-boggling to think of. And I should stress that we have 6,000 pages of his notes. He did write maybe 20,000, and so there are some 14,000 lost. So maybe in those there is something. When I was writing the book, I found a reference to corn. And corn, of course, came from the New World, and he ordered some specially from Florence. And I thought, aha, here is Leonardo eating food from the New World. But one of my Italian friends said, no, 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 the word that he's using there is referring to a very particular type of grain from Tuscany, and so it's not New World corn. Leonardo refers to many natural events that have occurred in Europe, earthquakes. He's interested in floods, all of things like that. He was interested in ancient literature and marrying up ancient literature with phenomena that he saw in his own day. But there is no mention of America, even despite the fact that Amerigo Vespucci was a Florentine and Leonardo knew the Vespucci family. So that's an incredible thing to think of, and I can't understand why he doesn't mention it. Your second question, how good a Catholic? Probably no better than many Italians of the 15th and early 16th century. He was not a heretic. There is an early biography of him written in 1550 said he was a heretic. The biographer then, in the second edition, changed that and said that he died in the arms of the church and et cetera, which may have – it's difficult to know how much of that latter statement is true. Leonardo wasn't a heretic. He wasn't an atheist. He refers to God a number of times in his writings, and his work on anatomy seems to have awakened his interest in what he calls the creator, the supreme creator. He said the human body is the most wonderful machine, and we must praise the person, God, who has created our bodies. But he was not devoutly religious, unlike Michelangelo, who was extremely pious, almost fanatically religious. Leonardo wasn't. But Leonardo was also anti-clerical. He liked to tell funny stories about monks and nuns and friars and priests and poke fun at them the way that many other people would. But he probably drew a distinction between his criticism of the church and the way its members behaved in his day, which, as you probably know, was not always that well, and what he thought of religion in general or of the God that he does appear to have prayed to and respected.
As time begins to get away from us, one other thing I just wanted to touch base with you on was the models that he used. And there is, of course, an ongoing story that he used the same model for Christ and for Judas.
Yes, that story is not true. The story very quickly is that he used someone named Pietro Bandinelli for the model for Christ. He was a young seminarian. Years later, he was still looking for his Judas, and he found some figure slumped in a doorway, completely debauched, said, "You're my Judas. You have the vicious, evil features. Come with me." And the guy said, "I know the way. I'm Pietro Bandinelli. I'm your Christ." That story was invented in the 19th century. There are stories that I tell in the book about who he probably used for Judas. We don't know the name, but he appears to have found someone in a poor area of Milan called the Borghetto, which was not a ghetto. It was not a Jewish area. Is the northeast corner. In the book, I discuss a number of people that he seems to have used as his models. All I'll say quickly is that they are said to be luminaries at the court of Lodovico Sforza. And one person who came in and saw the Last Supper said, "I see not only Christ and the 12 apostles, but I see all a kind of who's who of Milanese high society." And I try to make the argument that one of those members of Milanese high society in the painting, in fact, possibly two of them, is Leonardo himself, because I found a poem in which someone describes how Leonardo da Vinci, it appears to be Leonardo he's talking about, put himself into his painting. And so I try to identify which one is Leonardo.
And we'll have the readers, they'll have to find that out for themselves in the book, Leonardo and the Last Supper. One final question, and very quickly, please. Is there anyone you could equate Leonardo with today?
Good question. If Leonardo were alive today, what would he be doing? Is maybe a way of trying to approach that question. I think he would be probably an architect. He really wanted to work in architecture, and so I think he might have been the Frank Gehry or the Santiago Calatrava or someone like that who's building big skyscrapers, majestic bridges, things like that. It was that kind of work that he really wanted to do, something that could wow everyone.
I want to thank you so much, Russ King, for being with us. It's been a pleasure. It's a great story and a tremendous job you've done on the book. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. Pleasure.
He is the author of Leonardo and the Last Supper. Again, Ross King will be appearing at the St. Louis County Library headquarters on Lindbergh tonight at 7 o'clock. He'll be discussing this book. For more information, go to our website at stlpublicradio.org. When we come back, Thelma Golden of the Studio Museum in Harlem. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.